Come, come, she said, drawing me into their circle. I don't really get starstruck, but as I was doing air kisses with these icons, I thought, how in the hell is this even happening? These gorgeous, important women were in the middle of having a legit kiki. I think that word gets overused, but this was a kiki of epic proportions. Mariah was sipping champagne and telling a story about some guy trying to come on to her. She is an amazing storyteller, deadpan. But landing the details about this chump perfectly as Whitney let out that amazing roar of a laugh of hers, it was like being invited to sit at the cool table. I had grown up watching all these women, dying to meet them. And here they were, having girl talk like at a slumber party with friends and inviting me in. Just some normal superstars talking about life. Stars are just like us, only not at all, because this was Princess House. I spotted our host across the room, sitting on the stairs and talking intently to Anthony Anderson. I later asked Anthony what they talked about. Jehovah, said Anthony. Prince was, as he would say, living in the truth. As a Jehovah's Witness rooted in his faith, he recognized that there were elements of his beliefs that could touch other people. He didn't have to buy the whole faith lock, stock, and barrel. But there were aspects that he found comfort and guidance in that he wanted to share. As he talked to Anthony, Prince moved his head ever so slightly. Even his smallest movements were musical. I was mesmerized watching him, and it took Matthew McConaughey to break the spell, running by with a set of bongos. Wow, I thought, that is a thing that guy actually does. Then I saw my friend Sanaa Lathan talking with Hill Harper. I spotted Damon Wayans making Renee Zellweger guffaw, and Selma Hayek dancing with Penelope Cruz. Suddenly, Prince just appeared in front of me. Thank you so much for inviting me, I said. Oh, God, I thought, what am I supposed to call him? Mr. Prince? He smiled. Stop, I screamed in my head. Shut up. I was petrified of saying something stupid. So I did. I feel like I should have brought a tuna casserole, I said. Fuck, you idiot. He raised one magnificent, exquisitely sculpted eyebrow. We're both from the Midwest, I said, unable to stop myself from talking. That's what we do, right? His face broke into a smile. I love tuna casserole, he said, in his low, deliberate voice. And I liked you on that episode of ER. I really liked it. How are you watching ER? I said. You're Prince. I see everything, he said. And I believed him. Looking around the room at a completely random collection of faces from music, television, and film. His parties also included writers, directors, and producers of all types of content. There was always a random athlete or two in the mix as well. It was all over the place, and completely inclusive at the same time. I'd never seen anything like it. There was a reason. Hollywood is extremely segregated. The whole idea of Black Hollywood, Latino Hollywood, Asian Hollywood. It's very real. And it all stems from who is with you in the audition rooms as you're coming up. Because you are generally auditioning with people who look like you over and over again, simply because of how roles are described. When it got down to the wire for the role of Sassy Friend Number One, these were the people I saw. That's how I got to know Zoe Saldana, Kerry Washington, Essence Adkins, Robin Lee, Sanaa, and all the Reginas. Sassy Friend Number One was a Black girl between X and Y age, and that meant a very shallow casting pool. When it came time to cast a family, I would meet an array of actors who all looked like me. Sitting in those rooms for hours at a time, multiple times a week, you get to know people. As you all start to rise, it's the same people who are now deemed the it folk who you sit in better rooms with. And those people become your community. They know the struggle you went through because they went through it too. And the rooms pretty much stay that way, no matter how high you rise, because for the most part, Hollywood doesn't really subscribe to colorblind casting. What Lin-Manuel Miranda did with Hamilton is literally unheard of. we Black actors meet in the room into which we are invited. But we are often barred from, to steal from Lynn, the room where it happens. The spaces where deals get made and ideas get traded. Half the time you get picked to do something in Hollywood, it's because someone co-signed for you. Oh yeah, she's talented, but more important, she's cool, someone with more pull than you will say. I hung out with her this one time. But how do you hang when you're not at the same parties? The biggest award show parties come with very rare invites, and the brown people you see there are the same brown people that have been starring in things forever. Unless you spend at least $5,000 a month on a power publicist to help land a spot, it's not going to just happen. Black actresses are rarely deemed the ingenues or even the up-and-comers. So your work or even a spark of public interest isn't a guarantee. But let's say you make it into the room, whether through pay-to-play or luck. You're in. You got the golden ticket. So let's go in together. First off, the light is amazing, but you're too wired from the red carpet to do anything but rush to find the closest drink. These red carpet appearances are timed to the second so that there won't be a big collision of big stars. Performers are scheduled and served up like courses at a meal. If your entrance is set for 8:30 and your car gets there at 8, circle the block, bitch, because someone more important than you has a better call time. And unfortunately, if you have a late call time, a lot of people will have left the party by the time you cross that threshold. That feeling, though, when this wall of cameras fires at you and you hear the machine gun rat-a-tat of clicks, is exhilarating. Your every move creates a new wave of shots. Once inside, you're just another beautiful person in this beautifully lit room full of writers, producers, directors, and studio heads. Yes, this is a great chance to network and get to know people, but if you are one of only a sprinkling of black folks in the room, how does that even happen? Just because you're there doesn't mean anyone's going to talk to you. Trust me. No one has vouched for you in the way that Prince had. You feel like an interloper, and you go for the familiar. Because you know who is for sure going to talk with you? The other brown people. Here's the thing about the hashtag Oscar so white discussion. Hollywood films are so white because their art happens in a vacuum. It is made by white filmmakers with white actors for imagined white audiences. No one even thinks of remedying the issue through communal partying. Inviting one black actor to the party isn't enough. Sorry, folks. We all know you can create even better art by truly being inclusive, but you're never going to get inclusive in your work if you can't figure out how to get inclusive in your social life. If you're an actor of color and you've never had the chance to hang out with somebody and show them you're talented and fun and enlightened and deeper than what you can submit on a resume, you never had the opportunities to be included. Prince created those opportunities just by throwing a better party. When he included you, you literally found yourself in the bathroom line with some of the world's biggest names in entertainment. How we gauge what success is supposed to look like is different for white actors than it is for black actors, and I am aware that half my resume looks like crumbs to many white actors. The films Deliver Us from Eva and Two Can Play That Game? These are hood classics, if not cult classics like Bring It On. A lot of people appreciate these films, but because there aren't any white people in them, they get marginalized and put on a separate shelf. They are underappreciated, but they never lost money. And I will continue to do these movies, ones I call FUBU, for us, by us, because I love them and I am grateful for them. I made lifelong friends on the sets of these films. The Black Hollywood community is so small that we all came up together and created opportunities for each other. These movies set the stage for 20-plus years of careers. It's a testament to the community that we, over the years, have always looked out for each other and pitched each other for jobs. I'm incredibly grateful for that love we have for one another and the mutual respect of talent that we bring to the table. None of us benefit from tearing each other down. There aren't enough of us. We need each other to lean on. Now, a lot of white people have been like, I have loved you since Bring It On. But the ones who made sure I had a career were black people. White people will say, oh, Taraji just came on the scene with Benjamin Button, and now look at her on Empire. The truth is, Taraji has been working for 1,000 years. White people just met Cookie, but Black people have known and supported and loved Taraji forever. I remember when Taraji got her first invite to one of Prince's parties. Prince was renting Katino Mobley's place and gave an outdoor concert. Taraji was pure joy, dancing and singing. Every single person at that party looked around and thought, why isn't it like this all the time? I was lucky to go to enough of Prince's parties that we developed a friendship. By that, I mean I went from saying Mr. Prince to at least, hey, Prince! His gatherings were always held around some event or award show I was going to, and the invites never came directly. One of the last times I saw him, he invited me to a small dinner party in Las Vegas. He was doing a residency at the Rio, and they had provided him with a palatial suite to use for his stay. In attendance that night were Ludacris, Hill Harper, Sean Robinson, Dave Chappelle, Tony Braxton, Atlanta DJ Ryan Cameron, and me. I was sitting between Luda and Tony, and we were all starving, waiting for Prince to come in and take his seat at the head of the table. Finally, he arrived, and we were served a squash soup. Before we started, he asked all of us to join hands in prayer. Dear Lord, he said, pausing dramatically, Jehovah. Luda, Tony, and I squeezed each other's hands at that. Honestly, I don't remember any other food because I couldn't shut up about how good that soup was. But I remember the conversation. Again and again over this epic 3-hour dinner, Prince kept looping back to spirituality and social responsibility. Even when I told him how much I loved his parties, he explained there was a religious component. I want to understand people, he said, to see what unites them. He was also funny, repeating phrases he found comical, like, I'm not saying, I'm just saying. Melodic punchlines over and over, keeping us all laughing. Then we went to watch him perform. It was after midnight by then, at a small venue so we could get up close. As his guests, we were closest to him, and it felt like as he improvised his set that night, he chose the songs based on the conversations we'd had at dinner. It was like the music was the soundtrack to us. I owe my marriage to Prince. That's what a connector he was. In January of 2007, Prince announced, with just a few hours' notice, that he was hosting a Golden Globes after-party on the rooftop of the Beverly Wilshire Hotel. When the text arrived, I knew where I had to be. I was heading up in the elevator with Diddy, always Puff to me, and Nia Long, when Dwayne's brother Donnie stepped on. Oh my God, said Donnie. My brother is your biggest fan. Who's your brother? I asked. Dwayne Wade. No shit, said Puffy. That's nice, I said. Listen, said Donnie, almost at his floor. We've been trying to get in touch with your people about co-hosting a party with him for the Super Bowl in Miami. Would you be interested? I was already seeing someone in Miami and was head over heels for that guy, so I thought, why not? I was not thinking of Dwayne as a love interest at all, and I didn't even meet him before the party. I brought Sanaa and Patti LaBelle. I was taking Miss Patti to the bathroom, and Dee happened to be standing at the top of the stairs. Oh, hey, I said, I'm throwing this party with you. Hey, he said shyly. We're going to be over there if you want to come join, I said. It was just courtesy. He seemed nice enough, but quiet. For me, there was no chemistry. I didn't take Dee seriously until much later. He became a friend, and then he became my best friend. We were talking about something completely unrelated to us, and I looked at him, and I just knew. I didn't want to be on this planet without him. I didn't want to not bear witness to him succeeding. I chose him. When Prince died in 2016, Dwayne took his death hard. He hadn't spent any time with Prince, and frankly, I was a little like, hey, there is a hierarchy of grief, you know? Shortly after Prince died, someone got hold of an old, little-heard Australian radio interview with one of Prince's protégés, Damaris Lewis. She was ballsy, quite funny, and she bragged during the interview that she could call Prince and get him to talk. She did, and basketball came up. Well, Dwayne Wade is my favorite player, Prince had said. Someone played it for Dee right before a game, and minutes later he teared up over it during the national anthem. I know this message from Prince said to him, I am on the right track. For me, it co-signed every wonderful thing I felt about Dwayne. We were both welcome at the party. The world mourned an icon playing Purple Rain, a song I adore, but I know he made 30 years before his passing. As tributes froze him in that amber, I noticed that stories of his parties started popping up on entertainment blogs. Whitewashed accounts of people begging Justin Timberlake to sing, with barely a mention of the black or brown guests at the parties. Either the authors didn't notice them, or they just didn't know our names. I mourn the icon too, but I grieve the vital connector who brought so many communities together long after he recorded those radio hits everyone knows by heart. He gamed the system to provide access for talented people to access each other. Perhaps if he were white, he would be celebrated as a modern Warhol, famous not just for his own art, but for creating a space where interesting people with money and talent, or just one or the other, could meet and create. His own diverse factory. Instead, the parties are reduced to jam sessions, just as the women he gave opportunities to, artists like Sheila E., Wendy and Lisa, Vanity, Apollonia, Chaka Khan, Susanna Hoffs, Rosie Gaines, Misty Copeland, Janelle Monáe, Damaris, are all reduced to harem-like roundups. Prince's women. I'm not saying, I'm just saying. I still wonder who could take up his mantle and if it's even possible. Who could be cool enough to bring all these different, interesting people together in the name of art and communion? I also have a selfish thought. In all the times I spent with Prince, I wish I'd just once had the balls to ask him, what is it you see in me that maybe I'm not seeing in myself? Chapter 20, A Tale of Two Martinezes. Okay, pass your homework to the front. I'm not going to say a wave of panic washed over me, but let's say it was a splash. I was 5 minutes into algebra class, the second day of my freshman year of high school, as the guy behind me tapped my shoulder with his paper. I raised my hand. I didn't know there was homework, I said, reaching back without looking. I had missed class the day before because there was a mix-up with my schedule. Besides, who gives homework the first day? Then you should have asked a friend, Nikki, Mr. Fuller said. I'd heard Fuller was a hard ass, a Vietnam vet prone to outbursts. I didn't know who was in the class, I said. You don't have any friends, he said. Well, we need to fix that. Fuller went to his desk and scrawled something on a sheet of paper before taping it to the wall. The sheet had F-O-N-U in large letters. Who wants to join the Friends of Nikki Union Club? He said. Now she'll know who to call the next time she blows off class. For a long, long minute, there was just a stunned tittering, and no one got up. Finally, the guy behind me walked over to the sheet and wrote his name. Ray Martinez. When he sat down, I turned to him. He leaned in to whisper, Do you like salt and pepper? Have you heard Push It? Cue the music. Ray Martinez was a sophomore who had just transferred with his little sister Kristen from somewhere in New Jersey. She was a year younger than me, and everyone called her Suki. They were Puerto Rican, which people not so lovingly referred to as Mexican. Pretty soon after the FONU incident, Fuller took an extended sabbatical. The big rumor was that he'd had a Vietnam flashback and thought a kid was Viet Cong. In any case, we had a slew of substitutes for the rest of the term. None of them were real algebra teachers, so the subs basically just gave everyone a passing grade no matter what. We had it made for the rest of the year. Ray was on my track team, and he could already drive any car he could get his hands on. We'd hang out all the time, bonding over our love of dance music. He had a yellow Sony Walkman with him at all times, and we would listen to the TDK and Maxell tapes his cousins made for him off the radio in New York City. We didn't have BET, and MTV barely played black music by people whose last name wasn't Jackson, so these tapes were golden. the music of Kiss FM and WBLS, freestyle, house, and hip-hop exuded so much emotion, and we were there for all of it. We started cutting class together, making a pilgrimage to Rasputin's, a record shop in Berkeley, to find dance singles. We'd return in time for track practice, having car dance the whole way back. Ray and Suki's stepdad, Jim, had an old-fashioned Studebaker, and Ray figured out how to jumpstart it without the key. Ray and Suki would roll over in the Studebaker, playing his cousin's tapes, and we'd joyride around, transported to New York by the master mixes of Black and Latino DJs. One time, we decided to write a rap song of our own. I say song, but it was just a bunch of dirty sexual lines with cuss words written on notebook paper. Ray put it in his pocket, and Jim found it in the laundry. Jim declared me a bad influence and forbade me from ever seeing Ray and Suki again. That lasted 2 hours. Ray started hanging out with all of my other girlfriends right away. In his Z Cavarici pants, Ray could blend in with the boys, but he took dance class. That was a tell for a lot of the adults around us who could detect in him what we kids were oblivious to. When it came to Ray, all of our parents were, well, there is no nice way to say homophobic. Not my mom, but certainly my dad. He and all the dads had nicknames for Ray. Sweet Ray, Sugar Ray, and one even referred to him as Reggae. It's not surprising. These were the dads who drove us kids into San Francisco to go to Pier 39 saying, "You're listening to KFAG San Francisco, rocking you from behind." When everyone you meet says fag, it becomes part of your own language. I would use that word to describe 1,001 things. Saying, "You're a fag," was akin to saying, "You're a dick." Like nigger, it was just a negative word used widely. And I absolutely used it widely. Even growing up with my very non-homophobic, open-hearted mom, the pull of assimilation overshot my common sense. One Christmas Eve, my sisters and I were listening to the cast recording of Dreamgirls and acting out all the parts. The doorbell rang, and it was Ray and Suki. She was crying, and the side of Ray's face was swollen. He could barely open his eye. Their stepdad Jim's family was in town, and an extended family member had punched Ray in the face. My mom tended to Ray with ice in the kitchen, and Suki just told me that the person had called Ray a bad name. Suki was a year younger than me, but in that moment we formed a small bond that would flourish. I decided Suki and I were Ray's protectors, even if I didn't know what I was protecting him from. Ray and my mom returned to the living room, and he just happened to know every word to Dena Jones' songs. Despite all of the obvious signs, I still assumed Ray was straight, because that's what I thought he was supposed to be as a teenage boy in Pleasanton. He would also go to great lengths to pretend to have crushes on girls, and he even briefly had a girlfriend. There was also a beautiful girl in our class who was desperate to sleep with Ray, and my crew and I pressured him to fuck her. We just wanted him to get some action. We had the same conversation over and over. Me, "You better fuck that girl." Ray, "I'm not ready." Chorus, "What the hell?" Looking back, this was the worst case scenario of peer pressure for a young gay man, and we just kept right on. At 17, we realized you only had to be 18 to see the live sex shows in the Mission District in San Francisco. We were good bluffers, so we'd head into San Francisco and drag Ray with us, basically forcing him into these clubs. "This is how to be straight. Look, that guy likes it. You will too." When I was a junior, Ray's sister Suki became my cutting buddy. We'd ditch school and go into Oakland because we had both developed a deep and abiding love of black boys. Every weekend, she and I would go to After Dark, an all-ages club 20 miles away in Walnut Creek. After Dark was like Disneyland for brown girls. Every time we went, we found something that never existed in Pleasanton, a whole room of boys who could like us. We would be so pumped when it came time to go out and put so much into coordinating our outfits. Our go-to look was slightly cropped long-sleeve sweaters with jean shorts and high-tech boots. My hair, I modeled after Janet Jackson in the Black Cat video. On the drive over to After Dark, we would always listen to a tape of La Trem singing Cars That Go Boom to psych ourselves up. La Trem was a hip-hop duo of girls our age. They'd met in high school just like us. After Dark was in an industrial park, and I remember the walk up to the door was everything. My heart would be thumping, and I would want so much to be a bad bitch and have every head turn when I walked in. The club felt physically big to me then, but it was just a medium-sized one-story box. They didn't serve alcohol, but older guys would come with booze in their cars. The guys were in groups, separated by city and car. There were these Suzuki Samurai guys, each with a small towel draped across the shoulder, which I never understood. Then there were the 5.0 Mustang guys and the guys with the gold Dayton rims. Even their hubcaps had a message. And separately, there were the ones who always wore polka dots and had Gumby haircuts. We collected boys' numbers and talking to them on the phone and then calling each other to deliver instant replays. My relationship with Suki developed separately from my friendship with Ray. I had two best friends. Ray and I shared a hunger for the culture of music that I only heard when I would go back to Omaha. He represented that slice of heaven. He had bigger aspirations than living in a nice house in Pleasanton and maybe achieving membership in a country club. He wanted to travel the world. With Suki, I had a kindred spirit and partner in crime, someone interested in the same type of guys as me. I never had to explain what I felt to her. She just got it. And like Ray, we shared a love of being anywhere but Pleasanton. Going to clubs with her, we met more and more people, and my world expanded beyond high school. When Ray graduated, he worked at a Marie Callender's restaurant the summer before college. My girlfriends and I would go in for discounted meals and talk about where we'd go after. Ray was always talking about going to San Francisco, to this one place where he really loved the food. He said he'd get an omelet. It just became a joke. Oh, Ray's going to San Francisco for eggs. It never occurred to us, or it never occurred to me, that he was going to be with his community. That was also the summer of Ray's fake ID. Ray and Suk had an older brother, Sam, who looked exactly like him, so he'd borrow his license. Anyone throwing a party knew to call Ray to get booze. It was always all love at the beginning of the party, but once people started drinking, the fag jokes would start. Sweet Ray, reggae. One time I was sitting on the curb at a party wearing overalls and my high-tech boots. I was finishing off a 40s of Mickey's Big Mouth, and some kids started in calling Ray a faggot. He didn't say a word, letting it pass. I began to see red. I broke my 40 on the curb and turned it toward the whole crowd. "He's not a fucking faggot," I screamed. "He's not a fucking faggot." I was threatening an entire party because I didn't want Ray to be other. I would have cut somebody. My friends grabbed me and drove away with me still screaming. I wish I could say that I was protecting Ray. I was protecting me. I already felt like an outsider, and I had run a shell game on all these people to fit in. I could not allow people to point out another way in which someone close to me was other. In trying to control the situation, I was unconsciously trying to control Ray. I went to the University of Nebraska for my freshman year of college. While I was home for Christmas break, we all had a huge party at a girlfriend's house. We trashed the place. So when we woke up the next morning, we set about cleaning up. I was in the living room doing as good a job with a broom as my hangover would allow. I noticed that everyone was acting cagey with me. "What's going on?" I asked. "Ray, just tell her," someone finally said. "Just tell her." "Nikki, I'm gay," he said. "Really?" I started crying. "Who knows?" "Everyone." "Everyone?" I said. "Ray, I am your best friend." "Everyone knew but me." He was taking them to gay clubs and opening them up to new worlds. And nobody could have open conversations about this around me. Least of all, Ray. People just got sick of it. He took a deep breath, and his tone became angry. Do you know how many times I have listened to you say faggot or fag? Now think of all the times you've complained to me about people saying nigger or talking shit about black people. You were so fucking comfortable using the same language. You were too selfish to know you were hurting me. You were breaking my heart every time. I'm sorry, I said, bawling now. Yes, you are my best friend, he said, beginning to cry too. And I felt like I couldn't share it with you because you were so committed to being ignorant so you could fit in with these motherfuckers. Was it worth it, Nikki? I've never been more disappointed in myself. I'd humiliated myself with my ignorance and in the process hurt one of the people closest to me. It was devastating. Again and again, I told him I was sorry, and when he hugged me, I melted into him on the couch. You know, when would have been a good time to tell me you're gay? I said. That time I took on the whole party, asshole. We both burst out laughing. About the lengths I had gone to protect my notion of his heterosexuality. I was too busy protecting our spots on a Jenga tower of assimilationist bullshit to be the friend he needed. Ray studied dance in college and then got a job doing entertainment on cruise ships. He was fully out by then, and he would send me letters from random places. Dusseldorf, Ibiza, Nicaragua. He was wild, living out the adolescence he didn't have in Pleasanton. When we talked about guys, my know-it-all controlling voice would kick in, lecturing him about safe sex. He told me he met a Canadian guy, and pretty soon he wanted to just settle down in one place with him. He moved to Santa Monica. Suki moved to New York to work for Urban Outfitters. My first ever trip to New York was to visit her in her little walk-up in Park Slope, Brooklyn. I was 22 and got lost on the subway. I remember going into a bodega to ask for directions and thinking I was going to be shot. Living on different coasts, Suki and I didn't see much of each other throughout our 20s. But when we did, it was as best friends again. As my career took off, she and Ray would joke about knowing Nikki Union, not Gabrielle. They were very aware of the difference between Nikki and Gabrielle. They appreciated Nikki and went out of their way to say that was who they wanted to be friends with. They wanted to make sure I didn't get lost. There was this magic time when Suki and I literally ran into each other in Vegas. It was early 2006, and it was like seeing a mirage. Neither of us knew the other would be there, and we glommed onto each other for the whole night. She had a secret. The year before, in July, she had felt a lump in her breast. She was 30, had just started a new position at Urban, and was moving into a new apartment. She didn't want to admit she had a lump. She made a doctor's appointment for September, but when the doctor canceled it, she never rescheduled. Life, as John Lennon said, is what happens when you're making other plans. It would be 6 months before she had a diagnosis. Advanced, metastatic, breast cancer. She made Ray call me because she couldn't talk about it. He was sobbing. Stage 4? I said. Out of how many? 4. She was afraid to tell me the exact same way Ray was afraid to tell me he was gay. And I was angry. How dare you not prioritize yourself? I wanted to yell at her. Because now I'm going to be without a friend. How dare you be so selfish? We always internalize the things that happen to other people in terms of how it will affect us. I had literally just run into Suk in Vegas. And then she goes and gets cancer? I wanted to ask her how she had time to go to Vegas and didn't have time to go get that lump checked out. As time marches on and you look back, you realize how easily this can happen. Like, oh, I've got this weird twinge in my thigh, but I gotta go to work. When you are busy, You don't think you have the luxury of taking time off to sit in a doctor's office. We all do it. Nobody wants to even go to the emergency room with a cut. Okay, I can't get the bleeding to stop. Fuck. I suppose I have to go. You knew 5 hours ago you needed stitches, but you were just hoping. In her case, it turned out to be stage 4 metastatic cancer. I didn't have that perspective at the time. I needed to be useful and control the situation I secretly felt she had created by not taking care of things earlier. Initially, she didn't have enough insurance to cover everything, so that gave me the way to go into fix-it mode. If money is the only thing standing between life and death, I told her, we're gonna get the fucking money. I desperately thought I could save her life. You want to get into Sloan Kettering? Hold on. Let me call my publicist and make sure you can get in to see the doctors at Sloan Kettering. The Young Survivor Coalition looked like the best organization connecting young women with resources and a path to life. So we were gonna go all in with the YSC. I would become their best celebrity friend. If we had the right amount of money, the right amount of connections, the right amount of networking, then we could beat it. Why else was I famous? I threw myself into advocacy, hosting small seminars to promote the importance of prioritizing your own health. I used the analogy that they use when you're getting on the plane. You've got to put your mask on before you help anybody else, I said countless times. If you prioritize yourself, you're gonna save yourself. In interviews, I would bring it up constantly. Is Will Smith a good kisser? You bet he is, I'd say. And you know you can bet your life on early detection. Did you know that 11,000 women under 40 are diagnosed with breast cancer every year? Susan G. Komen made me a Circle of Promise ambassador, then a global ambassador. In 2008, they sent me to Kumasi, Ghana, to help dedicate the country's first breast health facility, one of the only ones in West Africa. I wanted to bring to the world the message that breast cancer is treatable and survivable. One of the speakers that day was Dr. Lisa Newman, an African-American surgical oncologist out of the University of Michigan. She was talking about what people can expect as far as prognosis. When I heard her say the word metastatic, my ears perked up. That was Sook's diagnosis. It's funny, I thought, I never really knew what metastatic meant. And then I learned. Of course, Dr. Newman said, there is no cure for metastatic breast cancer. Everything else was drowned out, and I heard her words as an echo. There is no cure for metastatic breast cancer. But wait, we've got the money. We are seeing the best doctors. We are doing all this work. What do you mean? Then it all became very clear to me. Sook was gonna die no matter what we did. There is no cure for metastatic breast cancer. This was 3 years into Suki's journey. A sister should have read up on metastatic at this point. I definitely shouldn't have been sitting there in Ghana, on the other side of the world, for my dear friend finding out that she was going to die, no matter how much I game the system. It was like that moment in the living room with Ray. I was the last to understand the truth I didn't want to accept. Clueless Nikki, thinking she knew what was best for everyone. For Ray and me, life became about trying to spend as much time as possible with Sook. She was still going full speed ahead, lobbying in D.C. and still trying to get into clinical trials for treatment. She got a great boyfriend and a dog. She had hope, but she was very clear that it was more about buying time than finding a cure. The thing that she was excited about was that while she was getting a few more months from the latest clinical trial, what they were learning from her would help other women. On one of her better days, I was in New York for some work event. We met down in Soho at this restaurant at a time when we knew it would be empty. We just wanted to be girlfriends. We held hands, and literally, as I was asking her what she wanted her legacy to be, what she wanted me to carry on, I felt someone standing next to our table. "I never do this," she said. She was a tall woman, well-dressed and looking like she knew better. I turned. "I am so sorry," I said. "This is not a good time." "This is just going to take a second," she said. Suk wouldn't look at her. Finally, I turned to the woman and smiled. I chose to satiate this woman's need just to make her go away. It was a minute, maybe a minute and a half with Suk, that I wouldn't get back. I returned to Suk and again asked her what she wanted her legacy to be, what message she wanted me to carry on. "I want you to tell people that fear can kill you," Suk said. "I was afraid, and it killed me." It was my last lunch with Suk. Ray called me near the end of the second week of June 2010. "Look, it's coming," he said. "If you want to be able to talk to Suk while she is able to respond, you should come now." I booked a flight to spend the weekend with her in New York. Then I got a call from one of the execs behind Jumping the Broom. They really liked me for one of the starring roles, but they had a concern about a false tabloid report that I had torn apart Dwayne's marriage. One of the producers was megapastor T.D. Jakes, and if I didn't go to a meeting on Friday, I wasn't going to get the part. I made the decision to go. I delayed my flight to get in Saturday morning. The meeting boiled down to, will Christian women go see a movie starring a supposed homewrecker? I so wanted people to like me, to choose me, that I was putting aside a very real situation that demanded my immediate presence. These people knew the situation with Suki. My friend was across the country dying, and they were still asking me if I was a good enough Christian to sell tickets. I could have had another day with her, or even just a few more hours, if I hadn't had to convince people that I am a good person. I didn't even get the part, and to this day, I regret nothing more than taking that meeting and trying to explain gossip. Rumors that were easily proven false, but why let a little thing like the truth get in the way of a good lie? But I was so stuck in wanting people to like me that I went to the meeting before I got on the plane. Just to try to plead my case to producers and an executive that I was not this homewrecker described by people who had absolutely no real information about the situation. When I finally got to Suki's apartment, Ray met me outside. He tried to prepare me before I walked in. "It's bad, Nikki," he said. "We've all been on shifts. She wants to die at home." When I walked in, you could smell death, decay. I will never forget it. The nurses had transformed her apartment, once this cute little bachelorette pad, into a home hospice. Suk's boyfriend was there, as was her whole family, her mom, her older brother Sam, and her two sisters. Her dad had driven up from New Jersey. And at the center was Suk, in a hospital bed they'd brought in. "I'm sorry it smells really bad in here," she said. "It does, actually. I wish some of our relationships gave off this smell," she joked. "We'd have known they were over." "Catch a whiff," I said, "and whew, see ya." What I loved most was when she said out of nowhere, "Will somebody go get me some hair removal cream?" A side effect of one of her meds was hair growth, and she was getting a mustache. Her sisters were there painting her nails, trying to make her feel as pretty as possible. I was ready to have deep conversations about life and death, but she wanted nothing to do with that, so I gave up control and allowed Soup to lead me. "I want to talk about the Kardashians," she said. That was Souk, a girl's girl to the end. Ray joined us, and Souk and I entertained her sisters with stories of growing up in Pleasanton. We laughed about the guys we loved from After Dark, and I told the girls the tales of Little Screw and my Greek-Mexican beauty school dropout. Ray mimed how to jumpstart the family Studebaker, and their mom pretended to be shocked at how often we'd done it. At the end, we are our stories, some shared and some lived alone. I wanted nothing more than for Souk's story to have a happy ending. She made it to that Wednesday, 5 years into her diagnosis. I won't turn her into Susan B. Anthony, but she definitely wanted people to prioritize themselves and their health and not be afraid of going to the doctor. To always get a few opinions and try to live your best life. She didn't want the conversation or our advocacy work to die with her. It couldn't be that Ray and I became breast health advocates to save Suki. But if we couldn't help Souk, to hell with everyone else. She didn't want that. To this day, I do what my schedule allows, and I am very active in supporting Planned Parenthood. They offer low and no-cost breast health care, and for a lot of people, Planned Parenthood is the only time they see a doctor. And I always try to incorporate health and wellness anytime I'm speaking, because now it just comes up naturally. Ray has the longest-running relationship of anyone that I know. He and his partner have a country home in Connecticut, the whole nine yards. As I was writing this, I could always text Ray to make sure I had the details down correctly. And so you, my sweet, patient, understanding reader, Suki made me promise to tell you not to act out of fear. I can only add that you can be scared to death, as I've been while sharing these stories with you, and do the thing you need to do anyway. Take care of yourself. This is Gabrielle Union. This production of We're Going to Need More Wine, Stories That Are Funny, Complicated, and True, was directed by Gabrielle DeCure and recorded at 48 Windows Music and Mix in Santa Monica, California. Engineered by Zeev Fisher and Scott Crisp. Edited by Ken Barton. It was produced by Skyboat Media. Executive producer, Caitlin Gehring. Text copyright, 2017, by Gabrielle Union. Production copyright, 2017, by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.